The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century, we look at healthcare in jails and prisons. The United Nations Commission on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice recently held its 34th session in Vienna, Austria. A number of side events were held during the session to highlight various issues. One of those panels was entitled Good Governance for Prison Health. It was organized by Harm Reduction International with the support of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime HIV/AIDS section and Penal Reform International, along with several nations which are members of the Group of Friends of HIV Prevention among people who use drugs and people living in prison settings. This side event highlighted why healthcare in jails and prisons should be integrated into national public health systems rather than managed under law enforcement agencies and justice ministries. I can think of some compelling reasons that are quite obvious to anyone who's paying attention, such as HIV, hepatitis C, tuberculosis, and the fact that most people eventually leave jails and prisons and return to the general community. But I digress. Drawing on international standards and real-world examples, speakers on this panel discussed the benefits, challenges, and lessons learned from countries that have undergone this transition. So this week on Century, we're going to hear presentations by some of the speakers from that event. First, let's hear from Dr. Justice Tetti, Chief of the Drugs, Laboratory, and Scientific Services Branch at UNODC.
It's a pleasure to welcome you to this important discussion on good governance in prison health. I'd like to express my appreciation to Harm Reduction International, Jerome, to you and your team for organizing this event, and also to all our co-sponsors, including the many member states who are part of the Group of Friends of HIV Prevention, for your steadfast commitment to advancing public health and human rights in custodial settings. Thank you. Colleagues, the question of how we govern health in prisons has garnered growing attention in recent years, and it's for very good reason. Prison health governance is far more than an issue of institutional arrangement or alignment and administrative responsibility. The way in which oversight, accountability, and service delivery are structured in custodial settings has profound implications, not only for the quality and continuity of care, but also for public health outcomes and the overall effectiveness of national health systems. International standards, including the Nelson Mandela rules, consistently emphasize the importance of aligning public health, or prison health in this case, with public health systems. Such alignment helps ensure clinical independence, it improves the quality and continuity of care, and it strengthens our ability to respond to infectious diseases, mental health challenges, and substance use disorders. These areas I've mentioned are critical areas of work for UNODC, and addressing them effectively requires integrated approaches, grounded in scientific evidence and public health best practices, particularly in high-risk environments such as prisons. Importantly, the principle of equivalence in healthcare, and I'm referring to ensuring that people in prisons have access to the same standard of care as those in the community, is not only a human rights standard, it's an essential condition for achieving broader public health goals. When care is inadequate or fragmented in custodial settings, the repercussions are felt well beyond prison walls. It affects communities. It affects systems at large. Today's event is an opportunity to reflect on what is working, where challenges persist, and how transitions in governance, when they are pursued, can be made more effective. We know that such transitions are very complex. They require sustained political will, cross-sectoral planning, and investment in institutional and workforce capacity. However, as we will hear today, progress is possible when reforms are evidence-informed and responsive to national context. Finally, colleagues, let us remember that governance is not only about who is in charge, it is about accountability, it's about coordination, and it's about impact. It is also about having data systems that guide better decision-making, mechanisms that uphold oversight and quality, and partnerships that connect care across the prison and the community, especially around the moment of release. UNODC remains committed to working with member states, partners, and practitioners to support governance models that are effective, grounded in science, and internationally agreed conventions and standards. Colleagues, in an era where health crises continue to test our systems, ensuring that prison health is not left behind is a matter of preparedness, resilience, and justice. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to the conversation ahead. Thank you.
That was Dr. Justice Tetti, Chief of the Drugs, Laboratory, and Scientific Services Branch at UNODC, speaking on a panel entitled Good Governance for Prison Health, which was held May 23rd during the 34th session of the UN's Commission on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear another presentation from that panel. Anna Koshakova is the executive director of the Eurasian Movement for the Right to Health in Prisons.
So while Jerome is starting my presentation, I'd like to say a few words about the organization I'm representing.
Anna, your slides are on already. It's on the screen. We can see it.
Okay, great.
The slides are uploaded already.
Thank you. We are a regional network of people with living experiences in prisons. Our organization has been created by people with living experiences in prison and is led by them. When we think about provision of health services in prisons, we may see that the organization of service provision might seem more simple than in the community, because there is no need to find people, to invest resources into case finding, into retention and treatment. And in fact, prisons could have been best practice settings in healthcare service provision. And we at our organization truly believe that the level of health of a person could be and should be even higher after the imprisonment than before they end up in prisons. But in reality, we all know that healthy people is not something that comes into our mind when we think about prisons. Bad living conditions, overcrowding, malnutrition, infectious diseases are all those factors that threaten health of people in prisons. But one of the most important factor, to our opinion, is that healthcare is not the responsibility of the authorities that are usually responsible for healthcare. They're usually the responsibility of law enforcement authorities like the Ministry of Interior or the Ministry of Justice, particularly in the region of Eastern Europe and Central Asia where we work from. And as a result of that, in prisons, the security requirements and regime restrictions, unfortunately, still prevail. No, can you go back to the previous slide, please? They still prevail over patient needs. And all the care and the service provision is linked to the security and regime restrictions rather than being linked to the patient's needs. We all know that healthcare services in prisons and in the community are not equivalent, particularly if we would be speaking about harm reduction services or drug dependence support services. We know that the same services that are available in the community, for example, a needle exchange programs or substitution therapy programs, in many countries of the region, they're available in the community, but when the person ends up in prisons, they become not available, and we have to deal with interruption of treatment. And for some reason, there is a thought that drug users, for instance, stop using drugs when they end up in prisons, but actually they don't, and we all know that, and they still need harm reduction and OAT programs. In addition to that, health right protection mechanisms in prisons are limited, and people whose rights are violated They cannot stand up for their rights due to many various reasons, including the fact that they are afraid of the further persecution if they complain about not getting certain services. next slide, please. So in our region, actually, this discussion has been going on for many years, and fortunately for patients in prisons, there have been a lot of progress in terms of transferring penitentiary healthcare from the law enforcement ministries to the Ministry of Health. And there are actually today there are two countries that have already transferred penitentiary healthcare to the ministries of health. The first country was Armenia. And we had a pleasure and an honor to visit Armenia last year, where we had a regional consultation on the perspectives of reform in penitentiary healthcare. The second country is Kazakhstan, who has already transferred penitentiary healthcare from the Ministry of Interior to the Ministry of Health. The process might not be finished totally in all the regions of the country, but officially and in practice, the healthcare, prison healthcare, is now the responsibility of the Ministry of Health. It was interesting that one of the participants of the consultations shared such a thought that, you know, the Ministry of Interior didn't want to give healthcare up, and the Ministry of Health didn't want to take it. And we all understand that this is a very complicated process. Yeah. This doesn't happen overnight, and it's a long, complicated process. It needs to be well thought and well planned. But from what we saw in Armenia, we already can say that this process is very beneficial for the patients, for people in prisons in terms of getting better access to healthcare services. I need to mention that this consultation in Yerevan it brought together representatives of the law enforcement ministries, ministries of health, and civil society representatives, and this is the format that we would like to see further discussions of transferring healthcare from law enforcement authorities to healthcare authorities, at least in our region. Next slide, please. So a couple of positive impacts that we already saw in Armenia after healthcare has been the responsibility of the Ministry of Health. There is definitely a higher level of trust of prisoners in civilian medical personnel. There is improvement in the quality of services, and there is improvement in the access to a wider range of services, because penitentiary healthcare cannot duplicate all the services that are available in the community. There is expanded opportunities for using national mechanisms for protection of the right to health. There is a possibility to maintain a single medical information space and maintain single medical information systems, which makes people in prison part of the general medical information space. It's very important to mention the independence of healthcare workers from penitentiary administration. Particularly in Armenia, the number of reporting of cases of torture has grown greatly because the healthcare workers didn't have to report the cases of torture to the prison administration. They could directly report it to the respective government authorities. There is also a possibility to optimize the procurement, and there is no need to have a special procurement system for penitentiary system, and there is an opportunity to get better prices for medication and optimize the procurement process. Next slide, please. Of course, as I said, this is a very complicated process, and it didn't go smooth either in Armenia or in Kazakhstan. Right now, there are two more countries which are discussing this possibility. In my home country, Ukraine, there has been all the legislative basis prepared, and there is a political decision that prison healthcare will be transferred to the Ministry of Health, but at the moment we lack funding to conduct pilot projects, but everything is ready and politically everybody is ready to go. In Moldova, there has been discussions going on and there has been some specific actions taken, like for example, the penitentiary institution are obtaining accreditation from the Ministry of Health, but there is a long way to go in both of these countries. Of course, such reforms hardly increase workload on the penitentiary services personnel and then the Ministry of Health. There is an additional needs in staff and vehicles to transport patients to civilian facilities. There is at some point an increased amount of medical reporting, increased burden on civilian medical facilities in terms of additional patients. And there is a need to invest to train civilian medical personnel on specifics of working with prisons, which definitely exists. But the next slide, please. So despite of all of the challenges, we as a civil society and community-based organization see this transfer from the law enforcement ministries to the Ministry of Health as the way to make the bars limiting only the freedom, but not limiting the right to health. And actually to end up with the Nelson Mandela quote that he said once, that if you want to look at the society, look at the way the society treats the most vulnerable people in this country. If we provide healthcare for prisoners at the same level as for the community, we can say that we achieved actually universal health coverage and finally made prison health public health. Thank you very much.
That was Anna Kashakova, Executive Director of the Eurasian Movement for the Right to Health in Prisons, speaking on a panel entitled Good Governance for Prison Health, which was held May 23rd during the 34th session of the UN's Commission on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's hear more about good governance for prison health. Another speaker on that panel was Ajeng Larasetti, Human Rights Lead at Harm Reduction International.
Before I start, I would like to take a moment to remember our brilliant visionary leader, former executive director of Harm Reduction International, Naomi Bergshine, who passed away a couple of days ago in Switzerland. Many of us working on drug policy and harm reduction have had the opportunity to know and work with her. And we as HRI team would be grateful if you could keep her and her spirit for humane drug policy in your mind, in your heart, and in your work. We have heard from colleagues from Kenya, Thailand, and South Africa on the country example, and we've heard from Anna as well. I want to take us to go back to basic and to the background to remind us of state obligations in ensuring good governance in prison. And I wouldn't take long, hopefully, because some of what I wanted to say have been said by previous speakers. Next slide, please. So more than 11.5 million people were imprisoned globally in 2024, and drug offenses are a major driver of incarceration globally, with nearly 20% of people in prison for drug offenses. And women are disproportionately impacted, especially in Latin America, where it is between 35% to 70% of women in prison are there for drug-related convictions. And while the likelihood of injecting drug use decreases with incarceration, as Anna mentioned, some people continue or start injecting drugs while in prison. An estimated one-third to half of all people entering prison have a history of drug use. And these possess an increased risks and vulnerability because majority of prisons are overcrowded, with only 30% of prison system in the world working within its capacity. And people in prison are more vulnerable to overdose during sentence and after release. And we also know the data how HIV prevalence reported among people in prison in 2023 was almost double than of general population and other statistics that we have heard before. So despite those, can we go to the next slide, please? Thank you so much. Despite those backgrounds, people in prison continue to be severely underserved by harm reduction services. As of 2024, the provision of harm reduction services in prison is still low, only 60 countries implementing OAT in at least one prison. And in most of countries, this is only a limited number of prisons within that country. Next slide, please. NSP is available only in 11 countries in the world compared to 93 countries in the communities. And this is only two more than in 2022. So the progress is not as fast as we would hope it would be. Next, please. In terms of take-home naloxone, it is only available in at least one prison in 11 countries. However, the level of coverage varies significantly, where naloxone on release is only available in 3 out of 100. For example, naloxone on release is only available in 3 out of 190 prisons in Italy. And within prison, naloxone tends to only be administered by staff, and this limits its effectiveness since staff will not always be immediately available in overdose situation, and the time they take to respond could be the difference between life and death. So next, please. So as recognized by UN agencies and bodies, equal access to quality harm reduction and other evidence-based health responses to drugs is essential for the full realization of the right to health for people who use drugs and should be available for all people deprived of liberty on a voluntary and non-discriminatory basis. These are the lists of standards, UN documents, reports that list that say that harm reduction is actually a central element of the right to health for people who use drugs, including people deprived of liberty. Harm reduction in prison is a human right. That's the bottom line that I think we all have to remember when we talk about good governance in prison, because at the end of the day, it's not just about good governance, it's about fulfilling people's rights, including those who are in prison. And states have responsibility to ensure that the access of harm reduction. In 2023, OHCHR published a report on the human rights challenges in addressing and countering all aspects of the world drug problem. And the Special Rapporteur on Health have also launched two reports in 2024 on harm reduction, and all of them recognize harm reduction as a central element of the right to health of people in prison, among others. Next, please. What I'm going to mention here and in the next three slides are the standards, the UN standards, the human rights standards that set obligations to states in order to fulfilling the right to health of people in prison. And these in particular speaks around the harm reduction provision in prison. The first one is states should provide healthcare for people in prison, including harm reduction and ART, to the same standards that are available in the community. On the right side of your screen, you will see where these standards are regulated, and you can see the various level of these regulations, starting from the Bangkok rules, the UN common positions, and also various treaty bodies' recommendation through their concluding observation. The next standards, can we go to the next slide, please? The next standard is that states should protect people who use drugs who are in prison against unnecessary pain and suffering associated with the withdrawal syndrome, and ensure that timely, adequate, and evidence-based medical assistance to counter withdrawal symptoms is available. And denying people who use drugs access to OAT, including as a way of afflicting criminal conviction by inducing painful withdrawal symptoms, is a form of ill treatment and might amount to torture. And the standards are regulated in several reports, several documents, as you can see on the right side of the slide. And the last one is that, can we go to the next slide, please? Is that states should ensure that all people in prison, including people with drug dependency, should be seen by a fully qualified health professionals to assess their health and medical needs upon admission to prison, And to this end, state must ensure that there is a sufficient number of suitable medical personnel, materials, and medicines to meet these needs. So these are three, among three standards, human rights standards that regulates and ensure access to harm reduction and health in prison. But if you, can we go next to the next slide, please? But I would also like to invite you to have a look at our human rights standards briefing, second on the list, which outline even more standards relevant to harm reduction in prison.
That was Ajeng Lorisetti, human rights lead at Harm Reduction International, speaking on a panel entitled Good Governance for Prison Health, which was held May 23rd during the 34th session of the UN's Commission on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. While we still have time, here are some closing remarks by Jerome Mangelinx, Global Policy Manager at Penal Reform International.
I won't take long. I just want to mention that Penal Reform International, on behalf of the informal civil society group on health in prison, we would like to thank the organizers, Harm Reduction International, and we would like to the HRI family to know that the legacy of Naomi will continue. We need more advocates like Naomi. We would also like to thank the co-sponsors, the Group of Friends, and the UNODC HIV section, thanking them to place the issue of good governance for prison health on the agenda here at the CCPCJ. We will continue through our advocacy work with the civil society group to push for this topic to be high on the agenda. And I would like to also mention that we have groups, members of the group here online and in the room, which means that we also have increased participation, increased advocacy efforts of the group in these spaces, which definitely need them. I would like to also acknowledge that from the country experiences, from the different experts who have spoken today, that the principle of equivalence of care is not merely aspirational, it is a right. And to realize that right, we need the participation of civil society, community-based and peer-led initiatives to bridge the gap between custody and prisons. So thank you again to everyone who have been showing interest in this topic, and be sure to get in touch with us because we will continue to place this topic high on the agenda here in these spaces. So thank you again.
That was Jerome Mangelinx, Global Policy Manager at Penal Reform International, speaking on a panel entitled Good Governance for Prison Health, which was held May 23rd during the 34th session of the UN's Commission on Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policies and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.